sky.
Good afternoon, everyone. My name is Matthew LeClaire, and this is Equal Time for Free Thought, the show where we promote and defend critical thinking, rationality, and scientific naturalism in an attempt to foster positive social change. My guest today is Dr. John Mather, a senior astrophysicist at NASA's Goddard Space Flight Center and senior project scientist for the James Webb Space Telescope. Dr. Mather received the Nobel Prize for Physics in 2006, along with George Smoot, for their work using the Cosmic Background Explorer to measure the cosmic microwave background radiation, which further solidified the Big Bang Theory. So thanks for coming on the show today, Dr. Mather.
Happy to be here.
So we're actually doing this at the AAS conference, American Astronomical Society. We're in one of their many, many rooms down here at the Gaylord Convention Center in Maryland, just outside of D.C., And I definitely want to talk a little bit about some of your personal background a little bit later on, but to put it into context for the listeners and people who may not know you or your work, can you start by just telling us a little bit about what you did in order to receive the Nobel Prize in Physics?
Sure. While I was a postdoc at the Goddard Institute for Space Studies upstairs from Tom's Restaurant on 112th Street at Broadway, I worked on a proposal to measure this radiation with a satellite project. So what is the radiation? It is the heat radiation of the early universe that has still fills the universe, and it's still very bright, except it's hard to measure from here on the ground. So if you were to put out a collector 1 square meter in size, you would collect 3 microwatts of this heat from the early universe. And just imagine a universe-sized collector, how many watts that would be. So this is incredibly bright stuff, but just really hard to measure. So in 1974, I had just arrived at Goddard in New York, and the idea was, let's measure this radiation as well as it could possibly be measured. So we can't do it well on the ground because the atmosphere of the Earth gets in the way. We can't see through it that well. We need it to breathe, but it gets in our way. So let's put up a satellite mission. It was a year in which NASA called for proposals for new satellite missions, and so eventually they got 150 proposals. So our team was lucky enough to be among the few that were chosen to go forward. And eventually, 15 years later, we got to launch this satellite into space. Within the first few weeks, we got wonderful data and were able to make our first scientific announcements. So we did indeed confirm that the data matched the Big Bang Theory. The universe was very hot and dense when it was young, that it's been expanding and cooling ever since. Eventually, not only did we confirm that, but we found the primeval structures, the hot and cold spots, that are thought to produce the structure we have today of galaxies everywhere. So this was the first time this had ever been done. So a truly amazing and remarkable accomplishment that was made possible by taking our apparatus into space.
And so you were talking a little bit before, you mentioned it really briefly, about the hot spots and the cold spots. What does that tell us about the history of the universe, and why is it important?
Well, number one, it tells us that the Big Bang wasn't completely uniform. Whatever it was that went bang, one doesn't really know. Whatever it was that was there had its own peculiarities. I guess we think of them as quantum fluctuations, but nobody honestly knows. The practical significance for us is that those are the things that caused the gravitation that would cause galaxies to be assembled out of the primordial material. So we're here having this conversation because those things were there. So there were a few regions that are a lot more dense than average. And by a lot more, I mean a part in 10 in 100,000. That's not very much.
Right.
But that was enough to break the symmetry and say, okay, those regions will grow and attract material into them and become galaxies. And the ones that were a little bit less dense than that, they were going to empty out and become cosmic voids. So this process has all been confirmed by amazing numbers of observations since our discovery. And so the whole picture is falling together remarkably well. And so this was, as they say, the beginning of precision cosmology, where we went from not knowing how old the universe was to having percent-type measurements of everything. And a pretty darn good agreement that this idea is correct, that this universe really truly is expanding and that it has a few constituents that obey the mathematics that we think should apply.
Yeah.
Everything fits, which isn't to say that we're right, but everything fits.
That was one thing that someone had told me here at the conference about how the data that you found matched a black body curve.
Yes.
What is a black body curve? And explain a little bit about that.
A black body curve. Well, if you were to have an oven set for 300 degrees so you can bake your bread, and you cut a little hole in the side and look in, you would see there was heat radiation coming out. And Planck gave us this black body formula back in 1905 or so that said this is how bright it should be at each different wavelength. All you have to know is the temperature. And there's this universal curve that fits all of these things. So we thought this cosmic radiation would have a temperature of 3 degrees above absolute zero. And so we put up an apparatus to see if it fits this curve that we were given over a century ago. And it does. It fits effectively perfectly. The error bars are too small to see now. So 50 parts per million error bars, which is incredible. And that was basically my thesis project, drawn up, put on steroids and made better to go into outer space. So that was that idea, and that indeed confirmed the expanding universe story beyond anyone's expectations.
What did you do in the meantime during that 15 years of development?
Well, in the meantime, everybody's working like crazy because we do not know how to do this when we start. All we know is that we really need to find out how. So we start off with the idea. Each of the instruments that flew had a concept, a sketch that we drew on the blackboard. In those days, we even had chalk. So we drew these ideas, and then we talked to engineers and said, well, if we could get this, could you build that, and so on and so forth. So this is not an idea where the scientist says, okay, engineer, please build it for me. This is the scientists and the engineers have to work daily together because it's so dang near impossible. Nobody could possibly do it if we didn't think together. So that's how it was actually accomplished. It was done at Goddard Space Flight Center in Greenbelt, Maryland. That's the big science lab for NASA. And so every day, each of us scientists was in the offices with the engineers talking about the things we couldn't do yet and how could we possibly get there. Because the thing we needed to build was so far beyond anything anyone had ever done before that it was impossible when we started. So we had to invent detectors. We had to learn how to cool things down to very low temperatures. We had to learn how to spin this apparatus around its axis at once every 72 seconds. The whole satellite spins. Had to put it in orbit around the Earth, meanwhile spinning, meanwhile making the spin axis point outwards from the Earth so we never looked at the Earth. All of these incredible engineering problems had to be solved so that we could make this apparatus to measure the beginning of the universe. And so that's what we were doing for 15 years. Nobody was waiting, not a single second.
It sounds awfully nerve-wracking, and I know that a lot of things at NASA kind of they have to develop this way. But is there any circumstance under which a project is worked on for, let's say, a decade, and then it just doesn't turn out? It doesn't work right.
It happens. Of course, when you get to the launch site, you realize your apparatus that you've been working on for 15 years is standing on top of hundreds of thousands of pounds of explosive material. And you count on the fact that the people that do that profession know how to do it. And it works right most of the time, 99% or so, which is pretty good, but it's not 100. So that's your moment where you really know that that it could happen, your apparatus would blow up. There are plenty of times during the preparation where you say, oh, my gosh, I've made a mistake. And this happened to me at least once where I wake up in the night and there's cold sweat running down my back because I knew there's a mistake that I made. And we better fix it before we launch. That happens. Usually, the big problem we have these days, though, is the launch vehicle. When we work on it long enough, hard enough, and test enough, our apparatus generally works. There have been a few exceptions, as you know, where we tried something that was called faster, better, cheaper under a policy of some years ago, which basically said we're not taking enough chances, we should take more chances so we can try more often. And the upshot of that one was we had too many failures in a row, and we said, well, that was too many chances. So we backed off from that, and now we're back to if you don't test it, it won't work, which is, I think, the correct approach. So we test. We test very thoroughly, and that's why we have a chance to have it work properly in outer space.
How did your work end up influencing the fields of science? What were we able to gain in terms of knowledge after discovering things like the age of the universe? How was that then applied to future work?
Well, okay, the significance of these hot and cold spots is pretty clear. In fact, I didn't fully appreciate it until Stephen Hawking said that it was the most important scientific discovery of the century, if not of all time. So I thought at first, well, that's just really nice of Stephen to say that about us. And then I started to understand what I told you before, that if those spots weren't there, we wouldn't be here either. So that's pretty important. So it also leads us on to new kinds of science, where we'd like to know what made the spots happen in the first place. So this leads to a thing which is kind of speculative still. What is the quantum mechanics of the early universe like? We have very few ways to find out about things beyond what the Hadron Collider can tell us. They gave us the Higgs particle recently, and that was the last missing piece that we knew of, except some more. The missing pieces that we know of are dark matter and dark energy, and both of those show signs in this cosmic microwave radiation. The dark matter makes the spots brighter than they would have been, so we can detect their influence, and they control the formation of galaxies. So dark matter has had every influence on our life. We wouldn't be here if it weren't for the dark matter, even though you can't see it or feel it. The cosmic dark energy, nobody really quite knows what that is, and as far as we could tell, we would be just fine without it. But it's there. And so those are the two still big missing pieces. And astronomers know about them because they're very clearly detected in our data in many different ways. But it's like the big mystery of physics. It's still the one that astronomers have found.
I read somewhere, and I don't know if it's true, but I read somewhere that you had read writings by Darwin, for example, as a child.
Well, I don't remember writings by him as a child, but my parents read from biographies of Galileo and Darwin to me and my sister when we were little, like I was 8 years old or something.
Wow.
So I thought, this is pretty exciting stuff. These guys discovered amazing things, and they got into trouble with their friends and colleagues for it, but that just proves how important it was. So I thought, well, science is extremely exciting stuff. It's dangerous, important, and I'd like to do that. Well, it turned out that I didn't know what that was for a long time. But I just read all the books that I could get about science when I was a child and gradually started learning more and more about it. I had a giant piece of cardboard, and I drew circles on it to show the orbits of the planets.
How old were you?
Oh, about fifth grade. I was learning about fifth or sixth grade, I remember, and finding out about how the orbits are ellipses and they're not centered on the sun. They look like circles, but they're not. And I don't remember all these details, but I wanted to be also a ham radio operator. I tried to assemble a Heathkit radio so I could talk on the, I could at least listen on the radio to shortwave. Anyway, everything that was available to a kid in rural New Jersey, I tried to do, which at that time was mostly get a book from the library. But I got them all. We lived on a research farm of Rutgers University, and where my dad was studying dairy cows as a researcher for Rutgers. So the bookmobile from the county library came around every 2 weeks to the farm, and I went and got all the science books. So that was my sort of connection to the big outside world.
And then what ended up leading you towards physics rather than another field of science?
I don't honestly know. I remember thinking, however, that I didn't have a mind for remembering all the stuff that there was to learn in biology. But when I got to physics, I thought, I can learn how to do these problems. I can get my intuition to match what the physical universe is doing. And so I got to be, I could see that I was good at it. So when you're good at it, you get a certain extra reward. And also in those days, there were summer courses available to high school students. So I went off to a math program at Assumption College in Worcester, Massachusetts, one summer, and a physics program at Cornell University. And that was so exciting. I got to hear about quantum mechanics and relativity when I was just after my junior year in high school. That was so thrilling. I can't tell you how thrilling it was to imagine that I could understand what those great scientists had discovered and begin to think about it too. And then as now, it was a time of great discoveries. And so, I want to do that. So that was pretty clear. Then I didn't actually expect to come back into astronomy, though. And so I didn't come back into what I'm doing now until graduate school. And I looked around for a thesis project, and my professors were working on this cosmic background radiation, which had only recently been discovered at that point, like 5 years before. So, okay, I'd like to work on that. That sounds cool. And I like the people, so that's how I got into it.
So I want to clear up what the distinction is between the discovery of cosmic background radiation and then your discovery that stemmed from that,
sure,
to differentiate between the two.
Well, in 1965, a couple of scientists working in New Jersey pointed their little radio telescope at the sky, and they found there was too much noise coming in from the sky. And that was Penzias and Wilson working at Bell Telephone Labs in Homedale, New Jersey. And they were not looking for this extra noise, but it turned out to be the cosmic background radiation. So they got their Nobel Prize for discovering it, just the existence of this radiation, which had been predicted but then ignored by a lot of people. So prize number one, discovering this radiation. So it was already the strongest evidence against alternative theories of the universe, the strongest evidence for the expanding universe story, the Big Bang. Our measurement was to measure that radiation extremely precisely, to basically measure the spectrum, which matches the prediction of the early universe story perfectly, basically, and also to find these hot and cold spots, which had been predicted by the time we launched the satellite, but nobody knew when we conceived it what there should be. So we took it to the next step. And, of course, that was not the last step. Two more space satellites have been launched, and hundreds of scientists are working on the ground have made more measurements of this cosmic radiation. So we're able to confirm the COBE results better, but also to much more detail about what they are. Those little speckles on the sky are incredibly important and to tell us basically seven parameters about the early universe: how fast it's expanding, how hot it was, how much matter there is, how much dark matter there is, how much dark energy there is, how much it was fluctuating in the early times, even how many neutrinos there are. So all kinds of things that you might never have guessed you could find from the random pattern of spots on the sky. It's not completely random. It's got these statistics to it that you can derive. And so all that came from something that we didn't know existed before.
That seems to be the killer for most people, is all of the mathematics that's involved in these discoveries. Is there any way of for people to understand the significance of these discoveries, or even better than that, is there any way for people to actually understand how these discoveries are made and are important without understanding the mathematics involved?
Well, sure. I don't think most of us that work on the project do the math on those spots. We just know that it was really important to measure. That was our motto when we started off: measure those radiation as well as you could possibly measure. And we figured that would be important, and the theorists, the people who make predictions and do the math, they would know what to do with this information, which they surely did. But astronomers or experimenters like me, we just have a basic faith that something's there in the universe to find, and we'll go find it, and it will be important. And so it turned out to be. We found the spots that led to our existence, and we confirmed that the universe is indeed expanding very, very hot earlier times. So that's the sort of thumbnail sketch. No, we really didn't use math to do this. We knew we needed the math, that somebody had to do the math, but most of us were working on apparatus design. How are we going to make the instrument that'll measure that thing? And the interpretation comes later.
Right. So what was the response like once you made this discovery? You made the announcement. I understand at one of the other AAS meetings a number of years ago.
It was here in Crystal City, Washington, D.C. in January of 1990. I put up my chart of the cosmic black body spectrum with the measurements right on the curve that was predicted. And I got a standing ovation for the chart. Well, I didn't expect that. I thought, well, doesn't everybody know that's the right answer? And the answer was, of course, they didn't know, because we hadn't measured, and we had many prior measurements that were wrong, including some that I had worked on. So it's really easy to get it wrong. And so it was a huge relief for the science world, and so I think they were applauding that it was a beautiful result, just naturally beautiful. See all the measurements fall exactly on the prediction is so spectacular. So afterwards, I could absorb why that was really, really important to people. Then we had our second announcement 2 years later at the Physical Society meeting here in Washington, and that was when we announced the hot and cold spots. And that one actually made the front page of the New York Times with a picture. And so we had phone calls from all over the world for weeks about that one. Every journalist had to write up the story about that one. And so we knew how important that was, too.
Did you get the sense that there was any particular response from fundamentalists?
I'm sure there was. I don't know really what they all thought. I don't really know what they thought. But I'm sure they're interested. Because I think the religious point of view is very interested in how we got here, and so is the scientist point of view. We just have a somewhat different story and different way to get an answer. Anyway, I think the science story converges eventually to more or less a single answer. I'm not sure how religious experience gets to a single agreed answer on this one.
No, the reason I ask the question is because I know that sometimes certain discoveries will receive a tremendous pushback from people who are very focused on their particular religious belief, especially if that religious belief instructs them to reject any science that ends up coming across them that's in opposition to what they originally believe.
Yeah.
So I'm interested in that part of these types of stories.
Yeah, sure. Well, there are certainly a lot of different religious experiences. I like to point out to people that neither science nor religion is a finished subject. Both territories have their own approaches to things, and they really mostly cover different subjects. Most of the importance of religion to people has to do with our understanding of our position in the world. You know, what is good and bad? What are our morals and ethics about? So anyway, the science has a method to approach a single story eventually. But of course, there are things that we can't answer either ever. People ask me often, well, what was there before the Big Bang? Well, give me a break. There's no hope that I know of for ever answering that question. It's clearly of great importance to almost everyone. How did we get here? And are we alone? That's a good question. Are there other intelligent beings on other planets having conversations sort of like this? Possibly. Not that we could find out. But I think we do have hope, as astronomers here are telling you probably frequently, that we're finding out a lot about exoplanets, planets around other stars, and it is within our technical reach to find out if those planets are alive, because we should be able to see the signs of oxygen in planetary atmospheres around other stars, and we think oxygen would only be there because of plants. So there's this huge interest in how do we get here, where are we going? Are we alone? And so science can address that, and maybe we'll have a few surprises for the thinkers and the philosophers about this.
I wonder why the fervor and the excitement tends to be more from the religious side of things than from the science. The discovery of cosmic microwave background radiation, for example, I generally would think that for many people it's less visceral, I suppose, to them than a particular religious belief. And I'm struggling to wonder why that's the case for so many people and what you think the answer is.
I think it's likely as important to people, except they don't know. If people are not familiar with the subject, they wouldn't know how important it was. But we're all familiar with daily life, And so mostly what we think about daily life is, well, who am I with? What am I going to eat? How do I stay warm? Things like that. And so we're most of our day is occupied with daily concerns. People go to church or synagogue and they think about other things for a while, but then it's back to daily life most of the time. So I don't think people are spending every minute of every day thinking about the afterlife either. What I think is thrilling for scientists is we're making so much progress in so many areas. Every day I read about a miracle in biology where I never thought we'd be able to do that. And people are talking about printing you a new organ if your body needs a new whatever. We can probably eventually make you one. Now, isn't that pretty astonishing? But it means learning how living things work in an incredible detail. So I'm a complete bystander on that subject, but I'm so thrilled to read what my fellow scientists in biology are doing.
For those of you just tuning in, I'm Matthew LeClaire, and this is Equal Time for Free Thought on WBAI 99.5 FM. My guest today is Dr. John Mather, Nobel laureate in physics, a senior astrophysicist at NASA's Goddard Space Flight Center, and senior project scientist for the James Webb Space Telescope. So I noticed that you talk a good deal, at least in the talks that I've seen on YouTube anyway, about the history of science, about some of the people that that you admire in science. Science heroes, who are they?
Oh, goodness. Well, there's some amazing people out there. The person that comes to mind today when you ask the question is Charles Darwin, because he wrote beautifully, and he discovered something amazing. And his book is like a modern book. He's full of all the stories about how he learned stuff and of thanks and appreciation to all the people who told him things, so that he makes his argument for the origin of species extremely clear, even though he could not know any of the molecular anything at the time. It's just a thrill to read that book. And so he's one, for sure. Einstein is obviously an inspiration because he was able to put his mind in such interesting places and imagine how things might be if you were riding with a photon, riding along a light beam. Things he was able to use his imagination, and he trusted his imagination, and it took him very, very far. I guess we celebrate his 1905, I guess, was his Anno Mirabilis, which he called, I guess that was his year. And we celebrate it as the year of physics now because he made four immensely important discoveries all in one year, all just by thinking.
What were they?
Well, I think I can remember them mostly. He thought of special relativity by imagining what is it like to ride with a light beam, to do an experiment on a train, his thought experiments. He understood Brownian motion, which is the random motion of little tiny particles you can see under a microscope, and he realized that that was because of molecules. So because of that, we were immediately able to tell how big is a molecule, which we didn't know before. He worked out the photoelectric effect. That's what he got his Nobel Prize for, this was sort of the beginning of the marriage of quantum mechanics and other things. So the photoelectric effect, as listeners no doubt know, is that when a light beam hits a photosensitive surface, electrons come out. And contrary to what you might expect, they come out with definite energy. If the light that goes in has a particular color or wavelength, the electrons that come out have a definite energy and not just, it doesn't get more energy if you give it a brighter light. So that was the puzzle in 1905 that he explained, and it was the beginning of quantum mechanics, which we didn't quite fully understand, and Einstein never did quite like the answer either, because it didn't go with his intuition. But he was nevertheless the first person to really figure out that quantum mechanical effect. And I guess in 1905 he also got E equals mc squared. So that became the basis of an awful lot of human activity since then. So that's pretty amazing year for that guy.
I wonder very often when I hear the words quantum mechanics. What is quantum mechanics?
Ah, what is quantum mechanics?
I think most people don't actually know.
No, well, let me see if I can give you a quick summary of the things to be thought about.
40 seconds, go.
In 40 seconds. the strange thing is that solid particles like electrons and protons, which we can measure in the lab, and they go like ping in the detector, and behave like little objects, little balls, nevertheless have wave-like properties. And light waves, which we've always known were light waves for a very long time because we see diffraction effects and how they bend around corners like waves do, nevertheless, they interact with solid objects and produce electrons as though they are like little particles. So what we've recognized for a long time now is that waves have particle-like properties and particles have wave-like properties, and these are unified in something called quantum mechanics. And so we now know how to calculate practically everything about this. Quantum mechanics dates back to the 1920s. And so what's mysterious about it is there's some very strange predictions that, for instance, some things are not completely local. We now are able to talk about things called entangled states and where it's not really true that information propagates beyond the speed of light, but nevertheless, it's useful. So we can set up a situation where two photons of light are tangled up in a certain way where if you measure the state of one on one side of the room, you know what the state of the other one had to have been. And nevertheless, they were never produced in this particular state. So it's a little more complicated than having a pair of shoes where if you know you found the right one, then you know the left one is on the other side. This is more complicated because when we make the photons together, they weren't quite like that. So that's turned out to be the basis of quantum cryptography.
That one I haven't heard of before.
Yeah, so we can now send encrypted messages based on this feature of quantum mechanics. So it's curious. We can calculate everything we like to calculate about it, and we still argue about what it means.
Does it seem like something that people in general today, particularly in America, do you sense that there's a general excitement about science among people, or do you think that has changed in some way?
I have no idea about the average population, but I see bright young people wanting to know everything about everything. And so at least the people I meet are fascinated by scientific discovery, and people just come from everywhere to learn more about what we're doing in astronomy. When it appeared, for instance, that our Webb telescope was about to be killed by budget questions a few years ago, people around the world rose up to protect their new telescope that they'd never seen, but they knew that they had to have it. When the Hubble Space Telescope was threatened with cancellation after the Columbia disaster, then we thought, well, maybe we can't service it. The public rose up and saved it. It's our telescope. You can't take it away. So I think there's a huge public excitement among some people, and a lot of people, of course, are unaware, but the people that care really care.
Well, speaking of the James Webb, I definitely want to talk about that, especially because I'm focusing on it for my thesis at Columbia as well. The James Webb Space Telescope will be seeing things in the infrared. Why don't you tell us a little bit about why that's important and what the James Webb is seeking to do and what questions it's seeking to answer?
Okay. Well, the Webb Telescope wants wants to study infrared light because it's something that's unexplored. So we sort of have a basic faith that if we look where nobody has ever looked before, we'll find something. But we also specifically predict that there will be remarkable things to find. Because of the expanding universe, we know that the farther away you look at things, the redder the light gets. This is called the red shift effect. Something that appears to be going away from you very fast will have longer wavelengths than things that are coming towards you. So we know if we want to see farther than the Hubble Space Telescope can see, to see back towards the formation of the first galaxies or the first stars or the first black holes, then we need to have an infrared telescope to see that far because the ultraviolet light that they emitted, those first objects, would now appear to us to be infrared. So that's number one. Number two, if we want to study how things like ourselves come to be, planets like Earth don't emit ultraviolet and visible light like stars do. They reflect a little bit of sunshine, but they're really faint. But they are much brighter for infrared wavelengths. If you're sitting there, you're transmitting 500 watts of infrared power, and if I had a telescope, I could see you very, very far away. In fact, the Webb telescope is so powerful it could see the heat of a bumblebee at the distance of the moon. Mm-hmm. So now imagine how far away we could see you. Anyway, so this is just a sign that you can learn things you would never guess about the formation of planets and the formation of planetary systems, how do stars grow from using infrared capabilities. Another thing about stars, by the way, is that we know that they're being born all the time. In our own Milky Way, there's probably about one new star every year. And we know where some of them are being born. If you look at that beautiful nebula in Orion in the middle of the Sword, some of them have been born quite recently over there. But we also know that you can't see it happen because it always happens inside a dust cloud. And the dust blocks completely our view with a regular telescope. Only after the star turns on and burns away the cloud that it was born in can you see it directly. So, however, if you used infrared, you'd be able to see around the dust grains and see inside the cloud and see that bright new star just in the process of being born. So we know this works. We already can test it, but we have a hard time seeing infrared from the ground. A couple of reasons for that. One is that the atmosphere absorbs the light or also emits its own. Another one is that the telescope emits infrared too. Just like you're transmitting infrared power, so is the telescope. So you can't build a telescope that sees very well if it's glowing itself. So that's why we have to take the telescope to outer space and cool it off to a very low temperature. So all of these things combine to mean that there's this huge possibility for discovering unknown things, and there's this huge, wonderful list of things to study that we know we are very excited about.
So I understand that you were there from the beginning of the James Webb Space Telescope,
yes.
Once called Next Generation.
Yes,
Space
we used
Telescope.
To call it Next Generation.
So how did your involvement come to be in this project?
Well, after the Cosmic Background Explorer satellite was done, I was thinking about what else to do. So I started thinking about, well, the next telescope needs to be bigger than the one we're building now, which was at that time called the Spitzer Space Telescope. So I thought, well, how about if we build one that folds up? And my friends laughed at me and said, we would never do that. It's too complicated. One day I got this phone message from NASA headquarters that said we need to study a new telescope to follow the Hubble. And it didn't have a name yet, but we're going to start right now. So send a proposal tomorrow. So, okay, call up this guy. He knows what it means. So we sent the proposal that next day, and it said, this is what we will do to study the new telescope to follow Hubble. Yeah, so there was already a book being written by a committee that said why we needed it, the story that I just explained to you about why infrared is great. And they knew that they needed a big telescope because Hubble was already big, but the things they wanted to study were faint and far away. So we needed an even bigger one. So, well, that seemed pretty intimidating, but we thought about it. We thought, well, maybe this idea of the folding telescope might work. So we went from, well, everybody laughs at that, to, well, it's really the plan. So maybe I should mention how this really got started. Also, the guy whose committee wrote the book went to see the head of NASA, and they talked with each other for a long time, and the head of NASA was Dan Golden at the time, and he said, I like this. He wanted to do this. He saw that this was truly revolutionary, and he thought that the business that NASA should be in, revolutionary stuff. And he came with some experience of the Department of Defense work that his company had been doing when he was in business. So he knew that it was possible in a way that astronomers might never have guessed. So he announced to the Astronomical Society in January of 96 that we would do this great new telescope, and he got a standing ovation. It's very rare. Standing ovation for an administrator. So anyway, that was the beginning of peer review for that project, and we knew that all the astronomers wanted it, pretty much. So now how can we do this? That's how it got started.
So how can we do this?
It was a long time to figure that out. At first, it was not possible at all because it required mirrors that were bigger than would fit into the rocket. It required mirrors that were lighter weight than could be lifted by the rocket. It required detectors we didn't have because they wouldn't be good enough yet. It required ways of cooling the telescope down. We had to build a sun shield that was big enough to protect the telescope. And besides all this, we had to get it really far away from Earth, about a million miles out, to where it was not going to be reachable by astronauts anymore. And we had to put it there so it would be able to cool off. So that's just some of the things that were impossible at the time. So it took a lot of work. But I would say by consistent attention to all of the stuff we had to invent and by having competitions for various industrial groups to say, they said they knew how to do this. Okay, now please prove it. So we actually made the progress. We got the detectors, we got the mirrors, we got all the designs that we needed. And finally we chose our prime contractor back in 2002. And now that they're the group that's responsible for building the observatory. Of course, they're responsible to NASA. They're doing it the way we say, but right. Yeah.
Now, why is the shape of this whole thing not at all similar to Hubble? It's not a tube, but
it's not a tube.
You can look this thing up online if you want to see it.
Well, word picture is, well, it's got a big umbrella, and it's got a big telescope hiding in the shade of the umbrella. And the telescope is shaped more or less like a solar energy concentrator with 18 hexagon mirrors aiming the light at a small mirror, and then that sends the light down into the instrument box. So that's the telescope. It's coated with gold, by the way, because that's the metal that reflects infrared light the best. So it's yellow, this telescope. That's sort of what it looks like, but it's because it has to also be unfolded after launch, because it's bigger than the rocket, it's this remarkable unfolding process that we had to also develop.
I don't think we mentioned how big is this whole thing?
Well, the telescope, the mirror, this 18 hexagons, is about 21 feet across. Each of the segments is about 4 feet across. So that's how that one goes, how to get the big telescope. So... But what's even bigger is the umbrella, what we call a sun shield, and it's about as big as a singles tennis court. So it has to all be folded up small to go up in the rocket and then unfolded after launch. That's probably our trickiest folding process because this is the first time that I know of that anybody needed a piece of plastic that big in outer space.
So how did your work end up changing with the James Webb Space Telescope once you got the phone call that that you had won the Nobel Prize?
Basically, it did not change. I still have all the same job that I had before, which is to work with the science community so the astronomers know that we know what they want to build, and to work with the engineering community so that we build that. And when, of course, it turns out to be difficult, that we make the correct choices about what to do or not do.
Right. I guess I'm asking in particular about the changes that something like winning a Nobel will bring about, particularly like time.
Okay,
well, I assume that you got a little busier after that.
Well, the big change for me was I have a lot more opportunities to talk to the public, to explain why we're doing what we're doing and how important it is. And I like doing that. So happy to talk with you, Matt. I think what we do is fabulous and fantastic, and I think the public ought to have a chance to know.
As soon as you ended up accepting this award, did you get any sense about whether or not you had any more capability of trying to encourage the scientific community to focus more on a particular part of science, or were you essentially treated the same by the scientific community afterwards?
As far as I know, I'm treated the same as before.
It feels the same, okay.
I have many more invitations to visit. But that's the main difference.
Right.
You know, unless you're actually working on a particular scientific topic, then you're still just another person. That's how, and I like it that way.
So now we're at the stage of the James Webb where it's been underway, the planning got started in 95, we're, I guess, 18 years, 19 years, somewhere around there later.
Yeah.
What stage is it at now?
Now we are a little less than 5 years to launch, which means that we have completed all the instruments. An instrument is a thing that spreads out the light and makes a picture or makes a rainbow, makes a spectrum out of everything that you're looking at. So that's what converts the incoming light into digits that the scientists can use and eventually turn into pictures so that you can see them. So those are all finished, and they've come from international sources in Europe and Canada and the United States. And we're really pleased with them. Two of them have already been tested together at Goddard, and the other two will be tested again with them this summer. So that's where we are with the instruments. Telescope mirrors are all finished also. They were probably the hardest part because each one of them takes years to produce. It's made out of, each one is made out of beryllium because it's really light and really stiff, and it tolerates the low temperature very well. So mirrors are done, the instruments are done, and now what's left is to put it all together and also to finish the design of the, quote, elementary part in the spacecraft box, which has all the electronics and the propulsion and the transmitters and the receivers and the memory and the computer and all the things it takes that are sort of normal spacecraft engineering.
And as an astrophysicist, what are you hoping to do once the James Webb is actually up there? Do you have any particular plans as to how you're going, how you personally would plan to use it?
I don't have a particular individual personal proposal yet. I will have to write a proposal like other astronomers do to get a chance to point the telescope at my favorite target. So right now I'm more focused on how do we make sure that it works, which is clearly my number one job. So there's this something like 2 months that it takes after launch before it's even cold enough to focus and for the detectors to work. And then we have about 4 months after that to get it all tuned up and ready to go for general scientific use. So during that 4 months of tuning up and getting ready to go, there's this vast number of tests we have to do and learn all of the idiosyncrasies of the telescope that we either don't know of or have thought of but we don't like, or whatever is not perfect about the observatory, we have to find out before we spend a lot of time using it. So at the end of those 4 months, so we should be able to command the telescope to do anything that we want.
And what do you think, do you have any speculation as to what types of things we might discover?
Well, I'd say it's not impossible that we would find some exoplanets that will with other techniques that will turn out to be a lot like Earth when we look at them with the Webb telescope. There is a mission that's been approved, well, partially approved anyway, which will find what we call transiting objects. What happens when a planet goes between us and the star that it orbits around, the star will blink a little bit and we'll say, oh, that was a planet. And if we see it 3 times in a row, we say we're pretty sure it's a planet and we know when to look again. So they'll give us a list of wonderful targets to look at, and we'll say, okay, let's point at that one over there. It could be like Earth. Let's get the spectrum. So a spectrum tells you what's in the planetary atmosphere. Number one, it tells you the color of the planet, how much starlight it absorbs and blocks at each different wavelength. And you can then interpret that to say, tell me about the atmosphere of the planet. Does it have oxygen? Does it have water? Does it have methane? Ammonia, all the kinds of things that planets might have. And if you want to know if it's got an ocean, you want to see, does it have enough water vapor in the atmosphere to match? So that would be pretty cool. If you got really, really lucky, you might find more things about exoplanets. But that's clearly one of the top priorities for people. And it's one of the hot topics here at this Astronomy Society meeting this week, too. So many papers about exoplanets because, as you know, we have an observatory up there now called the Kepler, which made something like 4,000 candidates planets to be tracked down. So a lot of stuff to learn about, and some will turn out to be really exciting. Wonderful surprises there. Looking back towards the formation of the early universe, I somehow have a suspicion, a guess, that we're going to find some unknown constituent of the early times, that despite all of our imagination, we will have missed something. So I don't know what it'll be. I'm just guessing.
Yeah, when you say unknown constituent, do you mean like a something sort of like a different type of particle? Or
More like a different phase that material will go through. You know, we imagine that the first things that happened were like stars, individual stars, very massive. Well, we don't know much about that. It's never been seen. So what if that's not the first thing that happens? Or what if they happen in little clumps? Or what if they don't just blow up like we think they would? What if they blow up in a different way? So there's a lot of mystery about those first objects, and I think we could find some more mystery.
So I guess the last question I'll ask you is more of an invitation for you to tell people who are excited by science but are very nervous about really getting into it because it can be difficult or it can be hard. What would you tell them to encourage them to continue to really try to explore these things about the universe?
Well, it has always seemed to me that difficulty and importance are related. So if it's really difficult, it might also be really important. If you have the ability and the luxury of being persistent about something, there's a remarkable distance you can go. I like to think that there's no telling how far you can go when you set your mind to doing something. When I was a child, I had no idea that I would be working for NASA. When we started the COBE project, I had no idea how important the results would be. When we started designing the James Webb Telescope, we had no idea how it eventually would be possible. But it seems to me that an idea has enormous power, and the imagination has enormous power. And if you are fortunate to have ideas that resonate with other people, then it's not you alone working on something. You end up working with huge crowds of people who want to do it too. And so it's not all about math and solving hard problems. It's about the imagination. And so it takes some persistence, but I think that's worth it.
All right, perfect. Thanks, Dr. Mather, for talking with me today. I look forward to seeing you again and perhaps talking more about science and all this fun stuff.
Thank you, Matt. It's been a pleasure talking with you today.
And that's it for today's Equal Time for Free Thought. If you missed any part of this program or would like to share it with your friends and family, visit our website at equaltimeforfreethought.org. And remember, tune in, pay it forward, and question everything.